welcome to another edition of Film Grok. My name is Serge Delpierre. To my right,
John H. Ruby.
My left,
Tim McMillan.
To my other left,
Curtis Nelson.
And today we're going to be doing the classic Planet of the Apes from 1968.
Mama.
That's from a later film. Thank you, sound effects gallery. Oh, Jerry Goldsmith. That's right, Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, yeah.
Music. Anyway, yes, we're not doing the Tim Burton 2001 version. That's for another time, maybe another lifetime, for all we know. This was the beginning of the Planet of the Apes series. But first of all, before we get going on all this stuff, let us sync up on our start mark. We have paused the movie right at where the 20th Century Fox logo has faded out. So it comes to black. So if you can go ahead and do that while we continue talking, we can all be paused at the same point, then we'll all start. Instructions are, I will count 3, 2, 1, play, you'll play, and we'll all be together on this.
Super.
So, Planet of the Apes, 1968, starred Charlton Heston. It was actually based on a novel by Pierre Boulle, who actually wrote a book called Bridge on the River Kwai.
Mm-hmm.
Made into a movie by David Lean.
Yes.
And it was called Planet des Singes, or Monkey Planet. And
right.
Just had a long, storied history about how it got made. Actually, Rod Serling was involved in the writing of the original screenplay. So, I really like this film, though it's not the first ape film that I saw. I saw Beneath the Planet of the Apes first.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm. Now, I'm assuming everyone has seen the movies, so it comes as no surprise. So I'm watching Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and I see Charlton Heston at the beginning, the James Franciscus and all this stuff, and at the end, Charlton Heston blows up the planet. I'm like, oh, my God, what just happened? So I had to go back and see the original one, which actually I saw it when it ran, I think it ran on TV, and it was very, very excited. So, and then, of course, I became an ape nut and saw all the movies, and history was made and all that kind of thing. Tim, please tell us your ape history.
My ape history. I doubt if I saw Planet of the Apes first as well, whatever was on TV at the time. So I think I saw Escape from the Planet of the Apes. That's my first recollection of the films. And I was a real little kid, and I was traumatized by the ending of that film. That is just too much for a little kid to take. So I knew that the apes films were very adult and grown up and shocking. That's the way I grew up with them. Then as I got older and watched them, just getting into the audacity of what this, of 20th Century Fox, what they did in this franchise, and learning the chronology that the first film wasn't meant for a sequel, and learning what they did in order to, you know, milk this money machine and go from the first film to how many films in total?
Five.
To the fifth film. And I think it's one of the most audacious campaigns in order to make a franchise that I can think of from a major film studio.
Oh, absolutely. It was, in looking at them in the past few years, I mean, they're some pretty dark films.
Yeah.
But as a child, I was just like, these are great. I mean, it was horrible. I mean, the end of Escape, you're right. It is just it's heartbreaking.
You just don't end movies. I didn't see movies that ended that way. It's always a happy ending. It's always inspiring. And I just thought, what is this? Everyone's dead, and the people I love, or they're dead, and the baby, and what's all going on?
But, you know, actually, I think this may be a product of the times also. In those times when they made movies, I think there was more of because it was the 70s, early 70s, I don't know. We can discuss it forever about that, but
right.
I think of that time, it was more of an acceptance of having a darker ending. I mean, you have to remember it was the middle of, basically in the middle of Vietnam. So there's lots of things that were going on. It was definitely wearing on the national psyche. Also, just in terms of the change of culture coming out of the 60s, going in the 70s.
It's not just entertainment, science fiction. This is incredible social commentary.
Yes.
That they did in this.
And they even do this in the first one again. It was fantastic. I mean, stands up.
John, what's your ape?
I'd like to say I don't think I ever saw Escape.
Have you seen the other four?
No. I think I saw. I don't really.
You have
remember.
Seen this film.
Well, I did. No, I've seen this one.
Okay, so the ending won't surprise you, right?
I have two stories. One with my, I'll go cross generational with you guys. One story has to do with my dad, and one has to do with my 7-year-old son. My dad, the first time I saw it with him, we saw the Statue of Liberty. You know, I'm sorry, spoiler alert. The Statue of Liberty in the sand. And he goes, The torch is the weakest part of that thing. That would have fallen off first.
He's a practical man.
I mean, he is. He is a very practical. He's a metallurgist. He's he's like, just wouldn't. So that was like, oh, thanks, man. That's just totally it.
So the ending hit home with him.
Yeah, that's right. Wow. Suck some energy out of there. Then my son, when I was watching this just a week ago to get ready for tonight, I let my 7-year-old son see the last 20 minutes of it. I didn't want him to see the beginning because I thought it was a little too crazy for him. But I wanted to show him the monkey outfits and everything and see how excellent they were. And so we saw the Statue of Liberty. And then 3 days later, we're watching Rugrats. They go wild. So they get stranded on this tropical island. And this girl drops her Barbie doll in the water. It gets washed up on land. And it's buried halfway in the sand with one arm straight up. And I go to Connor. I said, "What is that?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "What does that look like?" And he goes, "The Statue of Liberty from Planet of Apes." I said, "There you go."
Teaching
buddy.
Your son well.
That's right.
There you go. So, interesting.
But I love it.
Curtis?
Well, a lot of people don't know that I'm a descendant of apes. And but I am, as maybe you guys are as well. But anyway,
some would argue that. Yes, that's another discussion.
Some might be closer
I actually might not have ever descended. I might still be one from my wife's point of view. Well, with Planet of the Apes, this is the only complete Planet of the Apes I've seen. I've seen all the other ones piecemealed together on TNT or whatever cable station was growing up with and everything else. And you know, I know the guy from Starsky and Hutch, is he in one of them or something like that? Or
not that I recall.
No.
David Soul and
no.
Paul Michael Glaser.
I'm getting confused with somebody else then.
Yes.
But either way, I've seen the other ones piece by piece, but never all the way through again. Just never had the interest, but I like them and I love them for all those reasons. But the only one I've ever seen all the way through is Planet of the Apes. And I saw it as a child all the way through for whatever reason. I started out where they're jumping off the cliffs half naked, and I was like, wow, this is interesting, I guess. And then just kept on watching and loved it. As far as the film as itself, and now catching up and seeing it several times since as an adult, I love it. It's an amazing film, and social commentary is there to be seen, that's for sure. I love it.
Very interesting. Okay. All right. Well, let's get we'll talk about this more as we go along. So let's get ready to start the film. So on my mark, 3, 2, 1, play.
Oh, that's what space looks like.
And that's Charlton Heston speaking.
Okay. So from a script point of view, here's the whole hypothesis statement, the question that he poses, which is actually a question.
Yeah, this definitely sets up the film from a moral standpoint, and it touches on everything in his dialogue.
Yeah, a lot was made of basically his... his misanthropy, essentially. And basically, he was sick of humanity.
Right. Yep.
And the irony of it is, of course, what does he find? Well, humanity's gone and apes have taken over.
And he's our emissary. Yep. He's the one representing mankind.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if everyone is familiar with Charlton Heston, but...
Who?
Well, exactly. But Charlton Heston was a really big star in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And he obviously, Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, what he's best known for. But he did a whole bunch of different films. And this was definitely a change of pace for him. Right. Where he actually went into essentially science fiction, though he didn't go into it as science fiction, did it as a drama, an adventure.
And then, of course, throughout the 70s, that's pretty much all he did.
Well, his career did change then, because then he did essentially the trilogy, The Omega Man and Soylent Green.
Yeah, and here's the question. Oh, did you do it already?
He already did it.
Oh, here it is. No, here it is. Right
oh,
here.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the whole big.
And he basically uses, you know, Captain's Log, you know, the device used by Star Trek, which had already been on TV by the time this came along, to essentially let us know what we have to know. Of course, Charlton Heston could read the phone book, and it would be interesting. But
The guy has presence.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Connery?
No, that's
I know.
Okay,
James Daly.
I like the egg crate thing on the ceiling and stuff.
Yeah, it's acoustic.
Yeah,
it's acoustic insulation or something.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, look, she's the only one that we see from the inside.
Mm.
The camera's actually inside the tube, mm-hmm. and we all know what happens to her. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Wow,
that's the only thing that really totally dates this movie is the some of the cheesy controls, you know. Once the ship, you know, sinks in the lake.
Once you get into the physical environment of the world, there's nothing that they're in.
I mean, they could actually.
Anything technology wise, that's the first thing that dates a science fiction.
That and haircuts,
except for the same little panel he's laying on there, you know, Jim Cameron sold that for Avatar.
Here we have, of course, Jerry Goldsmith's awesome score,
an amazing score. If you look at the time that the score came out, it broke ground. Just phenomenal in the environment that it creates through sound for the picture. It's atonal. It doesn't have seriously structured melody lines. It's not something melodic. Away from the film, I usually am not one to listen to this score, but I think it's one of the most perfect scores to a picture that is ever written.
Well, you and I have had that conversation before, Tim, where that's what Jerry Goldsmith was so good at, was scoring the film. He wasn't scoring necessarily something that you could go back and visit on your iPod. Well, you know, your
record
stereo
player.
Or a record player that you're going to listen to over and over, but it serves the film so well.
He served the film. Very well put. He served the film first. And Leon Shamroy, amazing DP.
Oh, that's right.
This guy does great work in this film. Everyone, all the top talents of 20th Century Fox, all their work is on display in this thing. A finely oiled machine, and really credit for this film for taking the chance about talking monkeys. Will the audience accept this? To put Charlton Heston in a movie with talking monkeys, to put all this money into it, to go on location, shoot the way they did, away from the studio, to take all the chances they did, goes to Richard Zanuck with 20th Century Fox. Him and Charlton Heston together really got this film happening. And made this exceptional film take place.
There's Rod Serling.
And I love the fact that it feels so twilighty at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so things that are all mixed up and.
Well, the music does orient you to the fact that this is not a normal experience. Franklin J. Schaffner went on, of course, to direct Patton in 1970. Great, great film.
He came out of live television, and so did Charlton Heston, and that's where they first worked together, was in live television back in the early days. And Arthur P. Jacobs, who was the producer, his credit, he's the one that produced every film, correct? Every Apes?
Yes, and before this he'd done what, Hello, Dolly?
No, I don't. I think he did Hello Dolly.
I think he did.
No,
it was Dr. Doolittle.
Yes, Dr. Doolittle.
With Rick Harrison, which was a bit of a flop.
That was a 20th Century Fox film.
Complete change of pace here. I mean, this was... this is Monument Valley?
This would be Lake Powell.
Lake Powell, okay.
This is all shot in Lake Powell. And they do a complete flip, this circle, as they're landing, and it made all the audience sick in every theater that this was shown in. It's a wonderful way to grip the audience and to say, what the hell is going on?
Right.
But, I'm sorry, go on, Sarah.
Well, I was going to say, this came out in 1968, same year as 2001, and actually won an Academy Award for...
Makeup.
Best makeup, exactly.
John Chambers.
Beat out 2001 for their makeup.
Stuart Freeborn.
That's right.
Who did, yeah.
Because they thought those were actual chimpanzees and apes in 2001.
Hey, come on, easy.
The irony.
Easy, Serge.
No, that's no. Because the thing is, the makeup in 2001 was so good. And here,
talk about bringing the audience into a film. That sequence of the crash landing is just phenomenal.
Right. Now, here I want to talk about the time thing. Is I know what they were trying to do, and it's a bit of the what I'll call movie science. It's like, okay, they've gone in space. They're trying to prove the theory of relativity. I just felt like in terms of science, they kind of stretched a little bit. Well, actually, in this one, they did okay. It's when they went back to it later in the series, I think, where it kind of, well, Escape from the Planet of the Apes is specifically.
Right, but in order to make the franchise continue, they definitely took liberties.
And I didn't mind that liberty.
I did not either. Again, it's the most, you know, amazingly audacious way to milk a series that they did. So I'll give them that.
And then right on top of that, of course, they have the
the nice screeching sound was
that's
quite
right.
disturbing.
So you take one horror and you put another horror right on top of it.
Look at this shot as that's we see nice. The ship in the water.
That's really nice.
Helicopter shot, we swing around, and look at the curvature of that lens. Oh, and beautiful second unit work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have liked someone to say that they were really hungry after being asleep.
I don't think they've had time. Yeah, or how about I've got to go to the bathroom?
Yeah. Well, now they, yeah. But, I mean, they could have said, yeah.
I don't know about you, but if I've been sleeping for a few years, I think I'd have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston went on record many, many times saying Planet of the Apes was the most grueling physical film he ever did in his long career. He said there was hardly a scene where he wasn't being sprayed with water, pummeled with something, running, jumping, landing, leaping, screaming. And if you watch his performance in this, it is a physically demanding role.
That's a great shot and a great cut.
Sort of reminds me of if Cameron lifted something, he lifted that too for showing the in Titanic where the flare goes up and the ship is so far away.
And there's just nothing.
Yeah, it's an amazing job.
But actually, also, it extends from what he just did. He's reading the atmosphere. Readings,
and it shows you how isolated they are. That is not a miniature. That's full scale.
That's nice.
Of the hatch being blown.
I think it's all full scale until the
it sinks. Shot,
right? Yeah.
The sinking is miniature.
But all that is full scale.
I can just see the guys off camera with their hoses. All the water shooting these guys.
Just okay, guys, it's coming.
Probably enjoyed it, every bit of it.
Dry ice beneath the ship here.
They'd shoot that in a tank, right?
I imagine for all that water runoff,
yeah,
they built the set in some type of tank. In the stage, or the stage was equipped for water runoff. From other
there we go, 3978. Now, for eight purists, you have to understand there's a bit of discrepancy in the series. Here it says 3978. I think it's later referred to as 3975, and then in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, they say they come from 3955. And then in battle, the date gets mangled yet again. So,
Why they do that? Just make a mistake, you think?
Who knows?
Yeah.
But if you're a purist, if you've been watching the whole thing, like, wait a minute, what's the date? But the date he did see was 11/25/3978. According to their time, I guess.
Plug your nose, Chuck.
That's right.
The studio suits got very nervous because Franklin J. Schaffner took an exorbitant amount of time shooting on location for the setup of this picture. It went on and on over schedule. And the suit said, you can't shoot anymore. You have to come back and start shooting the rest of the picture. Schaffner said, I will not. It is essential to this film that I have this amount of time to set up the premise for what's happening and to be on location to make the audience wonder and wonder and wonder what's going on. Mm-hmm. And he won out. And this footage truly makes the picture.
Yeah, right. Sure. There. That's actually model. Very good model.
It also makes points for the story that they can't go and find their spaceship.
Yep.
So they can't prove that they're from the future.
It's done.
What I like about the three characters is they're so different, each and every one of them. And of course, Charlton Heston is the man of reality. And he plays it up. He twirls a mustache whenever he's talking to that guy, though.
Oh yeah, they have an animosity.
Yeah,
definitely.
They hate each other. And he's almost too realistic. It's almost like too much of, we're here and we're here to stay. Just get with it, son. You know?
I knew it would be long before we had a Charlton Heston impression for Curtis. There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, Charlton Heston would have been a pain in the ass to be away for, you know. He just wants to needle everyone.
He's already busting this guy's balls.
Right. He hates humanity. You think humanity sucks. It's like, whatever. We're here.
Setting the energy in your new home and this adventure, and he gives you that energy, I'd be pissed off too if this is the guy I was stuck on an alien world with.
You're a loser, and we're going to be together now.
But strangely enough, he's the character that survives.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, on a basic human human level, he's the one that could survive. That's probably the reason. Like, he's the one that could.
But when they get all swept up, I mean, it's all indiscriminate. He just it is happenstance. He happens to be the one that happens to fall back.
Well, okay, but is he? That's the question. But is he, or is he really just the guy that can deal with it?
Well,
that's probably the answer. On a human level.
Well, up to that time, I mean, Dodge gets shot. Landon gets captured and lobotomized.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Heston actually has the most heart, or I don't know about the most heart, but...
Well, but he's also the character that's going to have the most change.
Yeah,
he has the most change.
Landon has the most heart.
To me...
Landon's also the most idealistic.
Charlton Heston, the man in charge, authoritative figure, plus, to me, he is definitely separated from his emotions.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have sentimentality, so he can survive. He can do the hard...
Okay, I can see that.
Right.
Difficult things.
Right. I can see that. Right.
Being the man in charge, he's the right man to be in charge.
He's not sent. Right, the guy's putting a little flag up and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
As opposed to something like, well, I'm saying like an Alien, where essentially, you know, the captain dies pretty relatively early, and then it's essentially, you know, one of the pilots, I guess, who survives. Sigourney Weaver.
Ripley. And I just can't help thinking, watching this footage, the crew, the equipment.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. A major film crew. They had to be flown in and out every day. Just what to do to pull this location footage off is astounding, folks.
All the flags either blocking off light or reflecting light.
Beautifully black backlit. Shamroyd does some beautiful exterior work in this.
Now,
look at that shot of the three of them along the edge next to the water.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, look at all the lights.
And this is where you're using your Panavision. You're using your scope beautifully, your 235-1 frame. Look at that.
Now, we talked previously when we saw Dr. No about the effect of the space program. Here definitely was the manifestation of the space program. This is in 68. This is like 2001, too. Also, we hadn't landed on the moon yet. And so this was a manifestation. We're going out to the stars, and what will we find? And this was kind of a concrete example. Well, this is what we're going to find.
Again, in context, the audience's, what was going through their mind while watching this.
Yeah, exactly.
At the time, how topical it was to the space program, absolutely.
Right, because, I mean, you have to remember, I mean, what, even 100, 150 years ago, people believed that there might have been life on Mars or even on the moon, and we were only discovering that there wasn't.
And it's always good to get a little bit of a crazy laugh.
Which was looped. His laugh does not sync to what's on picture if you watch and listen at the same time.
It's fine. But also the way Schaffner just shot it, I love Schaffner as a director. He just did such a great job of setting this scene and letting us know where they were in the environment.
And this wouldn't happen today in today's running times to take this much time to just go and go and go.
And for any... not that they ever will, but for any studio head that ever listens to this, I let my two kids watch this with me, and they were enthralled throughout the whole film. One is 11, and the other one is 8.5. Never once did they ask questions like, why is this, why is that? I mean, they asked the general questions you might ask, but they were never confused. They knew exactly where everything was, how everything was going on, down, who the apes were, who the men... You didn't have to explain anything to them, and they were blown away by it.
Wow.
So all these people on the modern time filmmakers who think that you need to dumb down things for kids or speak like a child to them, no, they understand exactly what good storytelling is, and this is good storytelling.
Well, the interesting thing is that...
nice handheld shot.
Yeah, the interesting... Yeah, going down the hill, really. Wow. The interesting thing is that this... The series really appealed to children to the point where they started marketing it to children. Remember,
yes.
As a child, basically, they have, you know, Go Ape Night. Oh. Go to the drive-in, and literally you'd watch all five films in one night and bring the kids. Kids managed to capture kids' imagination, and they could understand it, even though it's adult themes.
Well, it's because it's like people talking truth. I mean, it's science fiction, but they're really talking about real, truthful things, and... Usually kids don't get the truth about anything.
Sure, so yeah.
I mean, well, that's true, yeah.
But I did have a playset, a Planet of the Apes little playset that had like a little spring-activated net. Mm-hmm. So, but I had a little Star
to
Wars
capture your little
press the thing and it come up and I'd be like, get your hands off me, you dirty stormtrooper.
That's a real boulder.
What
too.
Did I have? I had the playing cards.
Yeah. Look at that.
I also got the models.
they're actually running because they're afraid of that.
Those
boulder.
Are real boulders. I'm sorry, Serge.
They're big boulders.
I got the figurines that you had to paint and all of that.
Of the apes.
Whatever
I could get. I had the Beneath the Planet of the Apes soundtrack.
This guy should not be out in the sun. I know it makes for a pretty shot, but when you're like exhausted and tired.
Dehydrated.
And you don't lay out in the sun. You take a break in the shade.
But speaking of your figurines and your toys, this is another aspect of Planet of the Apes that was a precedent. Merchandising.
Merchandising, yes. Mm-hmm. No. Absolutely. Oh,
oh my gosh, 20th Century Fox, the machine that they made of this thing.
They cleaned up. Oh, I bought all the books, you know, the novelizations from the movie.
Yep. Extreme merchandising also, that never was to that point before.
Marvel made a larger format black and white comic series.
All the comics,
which is really good. And then this spawned, of course, it spawned TV series.
James Naughton and Roddy McDowell was in the 1974. Lasted for one
James
season.
And then the blonde guy you're thinking of, his name's Ron something.
It was a TV series, right?
Yep. And then there was an animated TV series.
Ron Hartman. Mm-hmm. I think his name is Ron Hartman.
No, it wasn't Ron. You're close.
No?
Hang on, let me check.
Always going to check.
Man, look at Charlton digging him again. I love it. He's just kicking his ass.
Right from the get-go.
Every time he can get it, he's like, you know what? You need to just settle down, kid, because this is it. You need to realize where we're at.
And that was a nice choice on Charlton Heston's part to be unsympathetic to the audience during this whole sequence.
Maybe
you're not endearing
just the way
yourself.
Charlton Heston really is.
But I mean, you know, most, if you're going to be a matinee idol leading man, you have the sympathy of the audience to be the hero from the get-go. And this is anti-hero almost.
Oh, this is but that was very much of the time also being the anti-hero. Right. And that's a very big departure for him. I think he played a bad guy once before. The Big Country, he played basically a bit of a bad guy.
Hard case. I mean, I interrupt real quickly just to take note of this tracking shot. This is him and James Daly walking. It started back at that last boulder, and it goes on forever. And I'm thinking the amount of track that was laid for this shot.
They took it. And
way to go, Grips. You guys
did
a good job.
They did it the right way. Now they just have a steady cam shot. A guy comes walking up the hill with them. It's like, no.
This is old school. This is big, heavy track, huge, heavy camera equipment on that track. What, five guys pushing it?
Probably people up top pulling it, too.
We keep tracking.
That's actually Robert Gunner playing Landon. James Daly is one of the apes.
That's right.
Yeah,
I stand corrected.
I had to correct you there.
Please do.
Yes.
Keep going.
Oh, it keeps on going.
See, but once again, all of this dialogue they're having right here serves the movie, and it serves the situation for later in the film.
Right, because they're questioning him. I mean, he's...
Of course.
That's exactly.
So, but as Tim said earlier, I believe it was, we wouldn't get this today. We wouldn't get this today. This just
but even,
lead
but even,
up.
Okay, look at the audacity of the shot. They're doing a dialogue scene.
With their backs to the camera.
And Shatner is basically following behind them. But also, Charlton Heston can play a scene like that from the back.
It also makes it, when he turns it around, that sentence is more important, than all the others.
That's a very good sentence. There has to be something better than man.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, like once it all leads to that. By the way, Ron Harper was the guy in the TV series.
I thought it was Hartman, but I was close. Ron Harper.
Very, very close. And then, of course, now they've gotten this far. It's been desert. They've been going across. Alien planet.
Can you imagine being in the theater in 1968 and just on a huge screen and leaving everything you know outside the theater and going into a world like this? Oh, that's great.
With Charlton Heston, that's the big thing.
Right.
Charlton Heston's in the film. It must be important.
Moses. I mean, come on. Ben-Hur and Moses. What's going on?
Exactly. Will Penny. You just done Will Penny before this, right?
Yes, I believe so.
What I always thought was that they get so excited about this life that they pull it up, which means they're basically killing it.
I know.
Well, it's a very human thing to do.
But it's interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting point, and I remember this making an impression on me as a child. It's like, where there's one, there's another, and another, and another.
Right. And they are gentle with it, which is nice.
Right.
All right, so let's talk about writing real quick. So
crane shot.
We're in this. Yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
On location.
Oh, there's a bit of a flare, but that was a nice flare.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, John. What were you saying?
So we're in the first act still, And so the big, so we got the opening statement with him on the ship, being the whole, what's this movie about? You know, do we still make war against each other? And then the ship sunk at around 8 minutes. And at 9 minutes, that's when they realized we're at 3,978 mm-hmm. instead of just the regular 700 years. So that really sort of the inciting incident. And then at 15 minutes is like, what's this movie about? They didn't really talk about, that's beautiful.
It was a very nice helicopter shot.
Again, all that beautiful second nice unit work.
What's really nice, too, is that they had clouds. Because blue skies, after a while, just look all the same.
Mm-hmm.
But the clouds give it texture.
Which was unplanned. I mean, just over the amount of time that it took to shoot.
Yeah. Mm.
And what's interesting in terms of what they've done before, remember, they've found the life, and then they've kept on walking and walking and walking. So the way they've paced it out, we know there's life out there, but now we still have to keep on walking further and further and further.
Right.
They're turned from astronauts into explorers, from exploring mm-hmm. space to exploring a planet,
which, a barren planet. Which, tell you the truth, I could lose a couple minutes here.
No, I differ on that.
I am too. This is otherworldly, and I am with them. I am living this experience with them, and I think it's just wonderfully timed.
And all of it is gorgeous. Every single shot, it's not losing me for a second.
And these poor guys, these principals, just, and now you guys, you walk from left to right here, and now you walk here, and now you walk here. All this footage.
I saw this movie about 5 years ago, and I was like, what the F, get out of the frickin', let me see something happen.
But this is the point.
So to you, it's only living up to the first word of the title, planet. All I'm seeing is planet.
No apes yet. That's right. See, but to contradict your point, my kids never lost.
Really?
I set them down, so we're going to watch this film.
And now you see.
But now you see that.
People in the background. Like,
and just, it makes an impact.
Now they know, because now they've been alone, and now we see.
And we see something they don't see. We're in on it, and they don't see it.
We see the Jawas.
Jawas. I tell you one thing that also keeps this going for me.
No, it's the sand people. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's the sand people.
One thing that keeps this going for me, though, is the score, once again, mm-hmm. coming back to that. And it's so,
that's a great shot.
So perfect for the film. Just amazing.
Goldsmith said, to paraphrase, that he just wrote his feelings of a movie. That's the way he responded. He responded emotionally to a film, and he put it into music.
Now, did he only work in post on films, or did he do pre-writing?
Depending on the project and how it went down and the amount of time they could give him, that would vary. But ideally, it was in post.
Now, here's an
but his partnership with Schaffner brought him in early on his films.
Okay.
And they made a great team because of that, and Schaffner went over themes and everything of the film so Jerry could start getting his score together in his head.
Okay. Here's an important point, is that now they're seeing these figures obviously that have been made by someone.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing, which took me like one or two viewings as a child to realize, is that they're coming from behind them. It's not like they're coming towards them.
Mm-hmm.
So basically they've been in the Forbidden Zone. And
right.
They're coming
right.
out
yes.
of the
right.
Forbidden Zone.
Right.
And
I see what you're saying. Yes. Like, these are the back of these scarecrows.
Right, exactly.
And, yeah. and then like, we come in the front, we're going to be introduced to the world.
And that's why when they hit the top, they see the water. Right. That's
right.
to keep people out of the Forbidden Zone.
See, now they're out of the Forbidden Zone, and you hear the water, you see the tree, and now we're on the 20th Century Fox Ranch.
In Malibu Ranch. And listen to this score.
It's a fantastic
Goldsmith
score.
Actually brought mixing bowls from home.
That's
he went through his kitchen and got steel mixing bowls and other things and would bring things to the scoring stage each day from home just for their sound. He was known for that. The people in his orchestras would say, you know, Jerry would go out to the street and get anything, top of a parking meter, if it sounded a certain tone, and bring it back into the stage and put it in with the orchestra.
Awesome. I love it. It's an amazing mix.
Otherworldly. It's mm-hmm. tremendous sounds. He had a wonderful ear.
What also showed the sound was so great with the excitement and the running.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
Now, did they shoot this whole film in Arizona, or did they film a lot of it in California once they
got
into
the This is now in California.
Yeah. Yeah. The second they come out of the Forbidden Zone, we go to Malibu Ranch, which is in California. And you can see the Malibu Ranch in what? MASH? Used Malibu
Everywhere.
Ranch a lot. Dr. Doodle used it.
Dr.
A lot of 20th Century Fox stuff.
Right. Well, yeah, it was Fox's ranch.
And this was a big deal, too, as far as 1968 and a major star nudity there in a major studio film.
Oh, yeah.
Except I got to tell you, when I was a teenager and watching HBO films, and at the beginning it said nudity, so then I'd watch the film, and then I ended up seeing a guy's butt. I was
Wait
very disappointed. I was like, okay, we got to get a little more clear with the clarification here.
Sorry, John.
Nudity chick or nudity guy? That's right.
And there's a footprint, of course, so now they know.
I think all that water is piped in for the waterfall.
I think you're right, because I've been to Malibu.
It's dry as a bone.
Yeah. Like, what?
So you got to give credit to the
movie magic
crew for that.
And I also like the fact that the in the writing, they had them carry those cases, even though they didn't really end up using them because they were stolen. Mm-hmm. But it
Good
made
point.
Sense at the time to take them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yes.
Even though they didn't need them for the story, they did what was logical at the moment. And I hate when people don't pick up a gun or do something
right
that would just be smart to do at the time.
Right. It's realistic.
So, yeah.
Right.
So nice.
Wear your clothes.
I like how, you know, it's interesting, even though it's not truly, it's not very real, it's slightly stylized. So you have that choreography. Of course, you have this choreography of hiding the parts. Mm-hmm. But the choreography of just as he's about to get there, the clothes are all taken.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This music is just beautifully timed, mm-hmm. just exquisitely timed, a picture. And his, what do you call it, ostinatos, the low piano rolls, just great stuff there.
It's a nice long tracking shot.
Oh, actually, the film was nominated for Best Costume Design and for Music. For Oscars.
Now, I wonder why that was out of focus.
I was thinking the same thing. The shot of their equipment on the ground, a POV, and it was very out of focus.
I know, I noticed that in the film we were watching the other night, I'll bring it up now, there was a lot of shots out of focus. And I was like, wow, is Blu-ray that good that you can see shots that you normally wouldn't see out of focus? You're like, that's out of focus.
Right.
Well, that shot that you just mentioned, why is it out of focus, could be just to make you... what am I looking? Words I'm looking for? Just confused, out of whack, disoriented.
Well, if you notice, I mean, they interspersed. They started using more handhelds during these sequences. I mean, there are definitely the shots of the crane. That was a nice crane shot in because that implies that there's more order right now. But even when they were running, there's a lot of handheld.
I also like this just shot of these people helping people. You know,
right? But the implication is that they're not. Actually, the interesting thing, the implication is they don't have a lot of intelligence.
Right.
Very limited intelligence.
Yes. Yep.
That they're basically...
Cavemen.
They're even beyond cavemen, just animal.
Right.
Yeah, then there's that.
There's the hot chick.
That would be Linda Harrison as Nova. Harrison.
That is my cave girl. I love her.
Now, I like what he says.
That was actually Richard Zanuck's cave girl.
Hang on, listen to what Taylor says. That's right. Exactly. We're going to be the kings of this place. And then, of course, just at that moment, they react like animals. It's like they can hear it.
This stuff scared wonderful. The bejesus out of me.
Look at that.
Everybody.
And there goes our piano, and there goes Jerry Goldsmith. This is called The Hunt, this cue off the soundtrack. And this is the one cue that, personally, I like to listen to the most from this film.
It's beautiful. Piece to me. It's great.
It is awesome. And they went through so much trouble to water the corn to make sure it's the right height by the time they had to start shooting. They had to irrigate and irrigate because it wasn't growing properly.
That's fine.
And it makes the whole sequence. They had to have that corn for this, shots like this, so the guys coming through.
And what's great about this is just the setup for all this, how they're running away. You have no idea who this is and how they take their time to reveal it to these guys.
It's all in the reveal, absolutely.
And I love the fact that they run and they don't even know what it is yet, just because... They're smart.
They take a hint from what's around them.
Exactly.
Well, they're tribal, and they're going on with what's...
And now we see guns.
Guns?
So we
what's
know
that? Horses?
We're seeing all parts.
I love the zoom shots right here when they reveal.
Yeah.
And talk about the physical demands of this role.
Boom.
That's great.
And this is a real ram's horn. Goldsmith got a real ram's horn for that sequence.
Right. See, here I'll take zooms anytime for this kind of stuff.
That was
Well, it's like it's an argument you get in with people that are purists of certain things in film. Like some people hate narration. It's like, listen, all parts of filmmaking are good if you use them in the correct way.
Right.
And
this is great. Mm. I love that high up shot where you see everyone.
It did.
There's your net, John.
There's the net.
From your toy set.
And then, of course, I mean, we're dealing with, I mean, this is like the sheer brutality of here they are. They're actually going out and they're just shooting people.
Yeah.
They're just shooting them. Shooting them, you know.
The tables are turned.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, of course, right now, this is where in the movie the social commentary really starts to take place in this film where you're just like blown away. And then you're thinking in 1968, well, even before when the book was written, you're like, wow, they were saying all this and they weren't afraid to say it at the time as well. Think of the time in which this was being made.
Right.
This sequence is probably the most grueling physical sequence of the film.
Yeah. Yeah, this particular one, I can see that.
And look at the dives. You guys are jumping off this.
Yeah, and that water can't be all that deep.
No. And Charlton Heston threw this sequence especially. Look at the beautiful shot, the net coming over the camera. Took everything he had physically to do.
Yeah.
They were, people were really...
That is not comfortable being drug over that in the net.
And then, boom.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And he trips right, he trips right over, and then he finds him. And just a few minutes, everything's changed.
And that character's name is what?
His name is Dodge.
Okay, that was Dodge.
Which he didn't do very well.
He didn't live up to his name.
Man.
Dodge will make a return in the film later, unfortunately. I mean, really, I mean, the biggest commentary is by showing the apes' inhumanity to man. They're really pointing out, I guess, man's inhumanity.
Yeah.
To animals.
Well, and then when you find out later that a lot of the reason they're capturing these people are for experimentation, learning, no different than what we do with
apes.
You know, apes and monkeys. And
of course, there was an important plot point. He gets shot in the throat.
Yeah.
So he won't be able to speak.
That's right.
Right.
Saves his life. So the shot in the throat thing happened at 35 minutes, and when they saw the scarecrows, it was 25, and then they found the water, it was 26, and then they were in the field at the noise, that was the end of Act 1. That is great. They just hold them there.
Well, you see essentially humans hanging like...
Yeah. Not too
like,
subtle.
Like deer.
Exactly, like deer. Exactly. It's not even like... Well, I don't know how we hunt apes, but we're hunted apes, but look at that.
And that can't feel good. I'm sure he only wanted one or two takes of this.
It brings up an interesting point. If we were to go back to ground zero once again and have apes and man on equal playing field as far as caveman and ape, they're both, which one, is there a reason why man evolved into what we were and apes stayed the same?
Hang on.
What made
part.
That?
Here's an important point. We'll come back to your
point. That's very fun. That's a great picture, huh? Yeah, I love that. That's so disturbing.
Now you have the introduction to technology, and?
I mean, that's so Twilight.
And they speak.
And they speak. And they, it's just like humans. Yeah.
The tables are turned.
It's just
too much. For, that's right. Yeah.
Sorry, I had to point that out.
No.
I've been to conspiracy conferences, and UFO conferences. So if you ever want to talk about possible how we
it's crazy. I mean,
I was going to answer, but you've got a better answer.
I got great stories.
In the development, the original story, Monkey Planet, they were advanced. The race, they had planes, futuristic cities.
Yeah, it was essentially
incredibly advanced, but budget concerns, they couldn't go that route for the film, so they made everything basic.
It's kind of interesting. I like where it is now as well, being set almost like it's like, you know, they're using cameras from like the 1880s and that kind of technology. Yeah. So, they're advanced, but they haven't fully.
Yeah.
And they're only a few hundred years away if you look at the human race from that time, you know, of being even more advanced. And so he's at the perfect time of meeting them.
Yeah.
This, of course, is that's Kim Hunter
as Zira,
who won an Academy Award for her work in Streetcar Named Desire.
Stage-trained actress.
She played Stella.
No.
Did she play Stella?
No, she's played Stella's sister in Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, she played the
Vivian Lee was Stella.
Yeah.
No. Blanche was the lead, and Stella was her sister.
Right.
And he yells Stella in the rain.
Yes.
No, you're correct.
His wife is Stella.
No.
And that's who he yells in the rain.
And that was played by Kim Hunter.
Kim Hunter.
Okay. Yeah, and over the hedge.
Carl Malden played...
animation Over the Hedge, there's somebody named something Stella and the cat. Oh. So someone ends up screaming, Stella!
But Sarah, you're absolutely correct. I was wrong. Blanche was the lead, and Stella was her sister.
And so now here we're basically getting it all laid out. This is all the first dialogue we're hearing for the apes, and basically, you know, the tables are completely turned. They're treating just like basically how they'd experiment on an ape, theoretically, or I'm sure is done.
They're both sisters, yeah, but Blanche is Kim Hunter, who's Stella.
Yeah.
That's Marlon Brando's girlfriend.
I like this guy's got like a Jersey accent.
Yeah.
The minute you open the door,
he goes into his act.
Well, he actually smokes a cigar later. It's funny.
Yeah.
What I'm fascinated is that they made the choice that the humans have become so primitive.
Yeah.
I mean, they're essentially acting like an ape, like apes would.
Yeah, was that the way it was in the book?
Or no? I don't remember. Okay. I mean, I think the book was different. Yeah. I read the book a long time ago.
Speaking of eyes, what makes her performance so good? What makes her performance so well good is you see her eyes so well in the way she acts and everything under
once
that mask.
Upon
is
a time
really, really
I was
good.
Falling in love.
Thank you, John.
Now I'm only falling apart.
Poor chimp.
Nothing I can do.
Don't do karaoke.
Totally.
Please.
Cliffs of the Planet of the Apes.
Do it again. I'll break your arm. That couldn't have felt nice to get a jab in the gut with a
broom. Yeah, you know, physical role.
And here we have Maurice Evans.
Oh, bad man.
Dr. Zaius. Is he bad?
Yes.
He's a defender of...
The faith.
The knowledge.
Bad.
It's interesting how they chose to...
He's not bad.
Oh, just watch the movie. You'll see badness.
I've seen the movie many times.
I find it very interesting how they chose the hierarchy between the apes. Like, she's more of a chimpanzee. Right. You got the orangutan. Then we have the gorilla.
Gorilla for war, military.
Right. Basically, they really made it into castes.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Essentially, the chimpanzees are the intellectual. Well, the scientists, the orangutans are essentially...
And emotional. Chimpanzees were the most emotional out of all of them.
The orangutans ran the place. And then the gorillas were the muscle.
Yeah.
The grunts. And during filming, Charlton Heston made a wonderful observation at lunch. The makeups, all the different class distinctions. Chimpanzees naturally gravitated towards other actors in chimpanzee outfits, and they'd sit in one table. The orangutan actors would be with the other orangutan actors at their table, and the gorilla actors with their...
Now, Tim, we cannot have you simplifying human nature that way. That is not how it works. In our world, everything is peaceful and perfect. And we all get along perfectly.
The like gravitated naturally to the like.
I cannot have you make any statements.
At lunch. Just out of being comfortable.
Audience, please notice the tone and sarcasm in my voice.
Are you being sarcastic?
King of.
Okay. Which is incredible psychology.
Yeah.
Note of psychology during the making of this movie.
Now, the interesting part of this here is that Dr. Zaius comes in, and of course, he is the authority and says, this is how this is going to go, and we're starting to see the layers of the ape society, and how basically, while Zira is interested in finding out what's going on with him, Zaius is, once again, I mean, I say, you know, controller of the knowledge, but that's what he's doing. He basically knows what's going on.
Well, he does, and he also, what's so great is... Dr. Zaius is also the voice of Charlton Heston.
Mm-hmm.
Charlton Heston is so upset with the human race for doing everything that Dr. Zaius actually says the human race does,
mm-hmm.
which is what's so interesting. And now
Charlton
Heston is actually on the other side.
It can't be bad to be Charlton for them to be offering up this. He's like, hey, by the way.
Like, hey, I got a roommate.
Just so you know.
It's because it's a movie.
What?
But exactly, they're treating him like they would an animal.
That's right.
But at the same time, they realize he's more intelligent and everything. So they're like, hey, let's breed these two.
But and once again, it gets back to also the choices. I mean, I think a lesser actor would not have been able to do what Charlton Heston quite frankly does, which is embody, he embodied the whole misanthropy, and now he's being made to face it step by dehumanizing step.
Mm-hmm. And
her, look, she's expecting him to like, well, yeah, come on, go ahead, procreate, just do what you do.
Well, her reaction is so great because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, you put two pandas together.
Oh,
and you're like,
you go to the zoo and you see a baboon jump on another, and the kids are like, wow.
Exactly.
Okay, now here's the big scene that is the 45-minute scene, the metaphor scene, showing how the ending's going to happen.
Ooh.
And I'll point that out with Dr. Zayas.
It's going to end with Cornelius.
The mainstay of the series, Roddy McDowall.
That's right.
Great kiss.
Nice.
Going back to what we talked about earlier, where the book was originally, you know, more
advanced.
Intellectual and advanced. Mm-hmm. What makes it great about putting it this time is whenever he does get his voice back and when he can speak, he can so go above their intellect
right.
and speak way more thoroughly about what the world is really like right. or what they don't know. It's pretty interesting.
So John, what's the 45-minute point?
It's coming up.
Oh, okay, it's coming up right now.
Right now we're...
Well, you just jump in when it happens.
Yeah.
All I know is they got... for the third Road Warrior film, this is where they got the cage from.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just kidding.
That's the Thunderdome.
Thunderdome. Welcome to Thunderdome.
So this is 43 minutes. It was when they kissed. And this is it's almost on the nose. So Heston writes something in the sand. And the 45-minute scene is a clue, a metaphor for how it's going to end.
Well, he's just introduced the fact that he's an archaeologist, which is what we see at the end.
Yeah. And he also wrote in the sand to show that he's intelligent and smart. Heston.
And we never actually see what he wrote in the sand, do we?
We do. Now he gets upset, which starts a fight.
Yeah, because the other guy wants to, of course, erase his thing. And then it's Thunderdome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Right. Where's Tina Turner?
Yeah, yeah, please.
This is the first cage match.
2 men enter, 1 man leave. Hulkamania coming for you.
Oh, ooh, good fighting.
Another physical sequence.
Nice. Ooh. Did he do his own stunts?
But once again, great score on top of it, you know. I guess we could say this the whole movie if we.
It's very primal. His percussion, his everything he uses, just a very primal score.
Mm-hmm. Now notice who notices the writing.
It's Zayas.
But I don't think we see what the letters say, do we?
We do.
Yes, we do.
Oh, I'm not remembering that part.
And now we're back to the expedition.
Yeah.
Brilliant, John.
Yeah. Here comes, wait for it.
Yeah, he just says what that he's about to witness.
That's right, yeah. And now Zayas sees, what does he see?
He just sees letters.
But that's what I'm saying. I don't recall what it said. It said write,
yeah.
But what around that? I can write?
Yeah.
But obviously now Zayas knows. I mean, it's what he said. I knew you were coming, and he knows.
Yeah.
This is what he's been fearing. He didn't know how it was going to come.
Yeah.
If you tried to explain that he came from the past, it wouldn't make any sense to him. Just knew that from the Forbidden Zone.
Yeah.
The truth, which was that.
Well,
that,
I mean,
that essentially that man went one way, and that apes essentially evolved separately from man, is true.
Well, going back to what we're going to see here later, whenever we go to keep talking, I think this movie to me is just nothing but social commentary, and how the political structure of man is always looking at a way to dumb down the society, keep them at bay, keep them lack of knowledge. They're okay with you not learning. They're okay with you learning, but if they can keep anything hidden, they're going to do it as long as they can. So to see that this was made in 68 and this stuff is still going on.
Oh, I mean,
it's like,
where was Vietnam at?
I missed what you said about people not wanting people to learn.
Well, go ahead, John, then we'll talk about Vietnam. Of course, then she sees that he can write.
My name is Tootsie.
My name is he's Taylor, not Bright Eyes. Which is, of course, a big plot point at this moment. It's like... basically, well, 68 was Tet, but this was done obviously before Tet. But already things, you know, we didn't know where it was going. But there was also, in terms of the civil rights, very importantly.
Absolutely.
There was an allusion to the fact of, certain racial... it was leading to racial tensions, essentially. But also, remember, the Scopes trial was back in the 20s. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing about evolution was definitely on their mind. And this was flipping what evolution... And this is about flipping evolution. And they get into this later about... Ronald McDowell's awesome.
But later they're going to touch on religious overtones and all of those things. And
Basically structuring a society. How do you defend how do you build up your society and how do you defend yourself, your society against essentially heresy, what they claim heresy, which is what they charge him with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the interesting thing is they can't process what he tells them.
Yeah, right.
The whole courtroom sequence. Absolutely.
And the interesting thing is he doesn't hear... Jefferson Public School, like that's going to mean anything to them.
Yeah. Why write that?
Let's point out the one obvious logical problem is that he speaks English and they speak English.
Yes,
but we're just going to ignore that.
Mm-hmm. Well, not if the apes actually learned English from the old people that were actually on planet.
Well, what if
that's what my mind?
What
put
if, what if he crashed in France?
We can't all. We couldn't have been so lucky.
That's a convenience you have to have in order for the film to happen.
I would have had to scrap Star Trek.
You know, I give them that.
I had a challenge
with all everything that's proposed in this film. What they do conquer, I'll give them anything.
Okay.
Around that.
I have to point that out.
But no, you're right. If you want to be a detailed.
Okay, I'm glad you corrected yourself there, Tim. If you want to be a. A snotty French.
Can I just say, look at that burn on his arm.
I want to say, I was just going to comment. When the first time I saw this, I didn't really realize he actually got burned in there. Yeah. I missed that.
Like, what's that?
What the hell kind of mold but thing
it's not,
is
it, No, it's not. It's not a burn. They put the
birthmark.
Important. He's basically telling you about the concept of flight, which they have no idea. It's like, what is that? Nice. As you pointed, that basically technology is back essentially 19th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously mishmash of different things. But.
What's wonderful to watch, Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowell found out early on, in order to act through these appliances, you had to exaggerate every muscle in your face. And you can see them working themselves silly under those appliances in order to have these expressions come through. And they worked beautifully.
Yeah.
He's just the way he's looking, like, okay, show me.
Now he's telling the story. He's recapping the story of where we've been.
Tatanka.
It's like Thunderdome again. I'm seeing some echoes.
Mm. Yeah.
And of course, nice cognitive dissonance. This can't be true. Mm-hmm. I can't believe you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As physical as this role was for Charlton Heston, he had it easy because he didn't have to have any makeup or appliances. So it worked out for him in that respect.
And here, what Cornelius just said, you know, I don't and I'm not going to try. Once again, we're going to deny. Evidence is in front of me.
Everything.
I'm going to deny it and I have to maintain my place in society.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's interesting. Yeah. When they did Escape, they didn't go along these lines and they just kind of plunked them right in the middle of celebrity. And they were there was some dissonance.
I could talk.
She just flipped the theory of evolution.
And I also liked how Cornelius, she goes, if you present the evidence, they'll have to accept it. And Cornelius goes, oh, no, they won't. <That's great>. Copernicus knew that.
How can scientific truth be heresy?
This still holds up today as far as like the scientific research, religion,
and
society.
And essentially
society.
Belief systems. And it goes back to what you were saying about how it is, it's basically, it's truthful. It is all truthful.
What do you mean? Yeah. Well, Copernicus got thrown in jail.
No, but the situations are all truthful is what I'm saying.
Yes. Oh, right. There's the truth underneath. Well, that's what's so great about science fiction is you can actually talk about truth without triggering people.
Right.
Yes. And they sure did it in this film.
But this thing is walking a fine line, not even close to. Yeah. It's not beating anything around the bush. It's hitting it square in the middle.
Yeah. They stuck to their guns.
Yep.
These filmmakers here.
Which
and it also shows the
he says he's up for a raise.
It also just shows
like my career.
Yeah, exactly. He just wants to get married and have a career.
And is that Woodrow Parfrey on the right, screen right of Maurice Evans?
Woodrow Parfrey?
Yeah.
Who is that?
He's a character actor. You see him a lot in 60s stuff. I believe it is. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I've only seen it written. Woodrow Parfrey, P-A-R.
Yes, he plays Maximus. Exactly. Okay,
there we go. It's like him, James Whitmore, the three orangutans that are on the council, right?
No, it's Zaius, James Daly, and James Whitmore. Maximus isn't on the council. He may be in the courtroom.
Okay.
Woodrow Parfrey.
I also like their outfit because it sort of looks like a tablet writing on their leather vest, so it looks very religious or something.
See, and now here he's presented with...
Evidence
of basically different technology. And as defender of the knowledge, what does he do?
Yeah.
We have to zoom in. Oh, it's a dolly.
That's a tracking shot.
That's right.
Yeah.
I stand corrected, and...
Ah, look at that. There's nothing subtle about that. Wow.
But once again, I think a lesser actor couldn't have pulled it off. The fact of it was Charlton Heston. It was Moses.
Well, yes, the way we're, as an audience, are relating to it because of it being him.
And movies are, for the most part, Hollywood movies do depend on the fact that you recognize the icons.
Yeah, you can save so much in a script that way, just having that instant identifiability. Is that a word?
Sure.
I like how these guards got Heston's attention. Yeah. We're going to geld him. And all of a sudden he's awake. Boing! Yeah. What? Okay, it's time to break out his mother.
Julius. I like Julius. Yeah. She's just a riot.
I do. I also like this guy just because he's doing his job. You know what I mean? He doesn't think it's right, but he's going to do it.
And he enjoys it, his job. Right, Heston went on record. This is one of the few films he ever got sick on. He always stated that he stayed in perfect health on all the shoots of all his films.
Bam!
He got a really bad cold in Planet of the Apes. And he had a serious cold at the time of filming right now that we're watching. Yeah. And when he has to scream out his lines, he has a rasp in his voice, which is from his cold. Oh. But he said it worked beautifully for the scene.
Yeah. And when he did that, he threw his hand in the air and went, beautifully.
And now the interesting thing is, here in film-wise, is that now we now get our tour of Ape City. We've only seen little bits, but now essentially he gets to show us everything. Mm-hmm. So we get to see a funeral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the funeral's awesome.
We get to see outside. I like the little ape boy. Mm-hmm. We get to be introduced to the lawgiver. Very important.
It is a great reveal of the world they live in.
I mean, I don't know how into it you guys are, but you know, the lawgiver was all about. I mean, that essentially was their, I guess,
religion maker,
religious icon.
Well, he's no different than a pope. Or
I'm just trying to think of a like this little kid.
Yeah, he's.
And of course, it's a child. It's not a human. Yeah. I mean, it's not an adult.
And we take it for granted, but when you look at these makeup appliances, what they did in this was a quantum leap.
But I love that. Look, it's a man. Everyone screams, oh, no.
Right.
Not a man.
Ugly, ugly, horrible man. Mm-hmm. It's a beast. It's a man.
Well, maybe it could just be, once again, because he jumps over the...
Did you notice how long that shot was?
Yeah.
Coming around?
It was one master.
A big, long track, nice, and then the dolly up.
It's a very nice set, too. Mm-hmm. That was not one of the better masks on the horse.
And you'll see it in some of the background characters here. Yeah. You'll see that is a 2-hour appliance compared to an 8-hour appliance on some of these people.
Of course, the fruit mart has to go. Yeah. Always.
See? Always.
Yeah.
The only reason you have a fruit mart in a movie
is for it to go, exactly.
And the architecture, wonderful set, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
The slope design of these buildings.
Even the ones in the background are nice.
I think it's just like frames with... Not paper mache, but something coated over it.
Yeah, every type of styrofoam or concrete type thing. I read about it a long time ago.
I always wondered how long this place lasted before it just eroded or was torn down. I'd love to see that place.
That's a little form there that comes back in a little bit when we see landed. That's right.
Hear that in the music?
In the music, yeah. It's great.
There's a great photo of Jerry Goldsmith with one of the ape masks leading the orchestra in one of the recording sessions.
The one thing I love whenever I see wide shots of this type of That's action nice. From the, nice this shot, era yeah. is
camera upside
you,
down.
You get to see the stunt work of these mm-hmm. guys and how professional they were, and you're just like, wow. So you just don't get you. Well, they still do it today, but you just don't get to appreciate it because everything is cuts,
overcut,
and quicks, and yeah, and you and, just don't get to see it.
Now here's the museum part, of course.
So this is the midpoint where the.
And this is the first. Now he sees clearly they're taking humans and basically
stuffing them. And
stuffing them.
This is the midpoint.
Get that piano.
Where, bad guy's worse than we thought, and it really gets example. You know,
we see it
exclamated.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so this is actually at a structure point.
Yeah. This is what also ties in with it's 10 minutes later. Ties in with his friend.
I like the camera moves. How they kept on were able to go up and down in mm-hmm. that spiral. The set design was amazing.
All the foreground
nice,
here,
nice,
the
nice
depth.
Shot over, nice yes. shot over the essentially the stuffed humans.
And the classic horror reveal whenever he turns into Dodge.
Yeah.
And of course, once again, human.
Yeah.
And there we go.
There
this
is.
Freaked mm-hmm. me out as a kid.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Wide eyes.
That.
You didn't see eyes like that very often in a movie at this point of time.
But it's horrifying.
In 68.
Here was a human who was basically, you know.
His poor throat. I mean, this guy's been through. How's he going to. His opera career is over.
It's like they give them direction. If you do anything, just crush his throat, please.
That's right. And, I mean, it's amazing. And he's basically led them all on this chase.
And I got to say, this music cue.
And then here's the metaphor. Here, look at it. We're pelting the man with fruit. Mm-hmm.
And Heston said, they were fake, but even fake rocks hurt.
Oh, it was rocks. Okay.
He got pelted for an afternoon.
That was fruit.
Like, I'm sure it's a mixture of fruit and rocks.
Well, it's interesting because it's more of a symbolic thing than because if it was an ape running through the street, you wouldn't throw fruit at an ape. You'd basically get out of the way and let whoever get it. But here it's essentially the saying, we're shunning you. We hate you. Mm-hmm. You're the devil. This is what we do to you.
And folks are coming up to an iconic moment in film history.
Yeah.
When Charlton Heston says...
With an incredible, wonderful sting by Jerry Goldsmith to end this music piece.
And a rasp in his voice.
Let's listen.
We should all say it all together.
No.
Yeah!
The man speaks.
Go, Jerry.
And that's right, she'd never heard him speak. And
she's excited by it.
And
that's pretty neat.
Intermission.
Scene.
That's awesome.
That's a nice shot.
I like it. He goes back to monologuing again.
That's right. He's Captain's Log.
He's
it's
monologuing.
Just me. I talk, you listen.
Nobody
this
gets
is my
me.
World now. But that's what he was
but
saying.
But I love the fact that she
give us 6 months while I run the place.
To, yeah. She even wants him to be quiet, which is great. She's like, enough
what is this
about.
Coming out of your voice?
Oh, Julius.
And this is where he had his cold. And he says, it's a madhouse. And he has the rasp in his voice from his actual cold.
I like what Julius says.
And he's getting sprayed with this water, cold water with this bad cold.
And me and my brothers, who often tortured each other quite a bit, we're only about a year and a half apart each. But we used to always be like, why couldn't he get away from this powerful water hose? Mm-hmm. Somebody go and borrow a water hose someday that huge, hook it to a fire hydrant, and spray someone with it. It's quite painful.
But also, there is... Hang on.
Yeah, you could actually see the muscles on it straining.
Listen, and they have it on lightly
listen,
there.
But Julius is just saying, shut up, you freak. He doesn't want to hear it. He doesn't want to... Basically, he's going against everything they believe. He's challenging everything they know. But also, I mean, the water hose, it's very, very clear allusion to the water hose.
Crowd control.
Crowd control in the civil rights riots in the 60s. Absolutely.
I also really appreciate that he finally just yelled, and it's a madhouse, because that broke him down, which was nice. I mean, that felt like a real moment. Like, this is insane. This is all
the
insane.
Snake pit.
This actually wasn't dialogue. This was just him improvising. Heston. No.
But he'd been so much of the film without speaking as an actor. I'm sure he's like, get me some dialogue, folks. Where do I get to talk now? and he takes advantage of it.
What's great about all the Heston films that I'm most familiar with anyway is like it does seem like he's always monologuing, even in Omega Man and everything else.
Well, it's not that he's monologuing. You know? He's just got a great voice, and he can shape the dialogue so well.
But he often is talking to himself instead of someone else. Yeah. You know, he's
but
like,
you know what? If Charlton Heston was talking to me and he's talking to himself, I'd still listen.
I think he just goes into a mirror.
Which it does make a comment that
you're going to have a good day today. Hi, how are you?
He can pull it off, and yeah. That's what you pay your ticket price for.
Should we go to the mall today, or let's watch HBO?
I mean, who's replaced him for that?
No one. Well, don't even get me started on modern actors and who's replaced anyone really from this era.
Mm.
Of all these famous actors, whether it be the Gregory Pecks of the world, the Clint Eastwoods of the world, the John Waynes of the world, the modern guys. You know, I mean, George Clooney, of course, reflective of a lot of those guys, but the Cary Grants and whatnot, but...
Poor Nova.
I like how she comes right back
to
that.
Yeah, that was very nice, yeah.
Good point, though, Curtis. His poor throat. Shakespearean actor, and you're going to do that to him? the courtroom.
And just the wild thing, once again, everything he's known has been adopted and turned around and essentially used by the apes. I mean, his civilization is now someone else's civilization. Mm. They're using it against him.
Good point.
What's interesting, too, is for him to have this kind of right-wing outlook on life and how things work in the world and have that used against him here.
What do you mean right-wing outlook?
Well, he has a very simplistic stance of the way life is, the way people are, the way the world is. But he wasn't ready to be put into this and have his own outlook of life and outlook of the way things should be used against him. So it makes him change as a character. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
So like right here, they're very simplistic in the way they're handling the situation. They don't want to hear what he has to say. Yet that's how he would have been in his own world and his own situation.
I think that's James.
No, that's Woodrow Parfrey.
Yeah. Or if, at least if not him,
No.
I don't know if he would have been the
white
Curtis, but
that's
how
Woodrow Parfrey
man
right there.
Was.
That's Maximus.
Yes.
That's Woodrow Parfrey.
That's how the whites were, in the 60s.
That's
James, hear it,
that was James Whitmore. Right
mm-hmm.
there.
That was James Whitmore.
People. That's Whitmore.
So is Woodrow Parfrey off screen left?
Yes,
the furthest
Maximus.
One screen left.
He's off to
the okay,
side.
So
that's
no, wait
really
a minute.
A bold move, writing and acting wise, that it just becomes humiliating.
But that's
to
the point.
Be naked. I mean, that's great. Yeah. I mean, how many?
Because he has no rights.
That's what I'm saying. How many films nowadays would do that?
Yeah.
They wouldn't. They just
well,
they
I
wouldn't
mean,
go
this
that.
Film went with it. They said, "This is what we're doing. Yeah. We're going."
So Woodrow Parfrey.
No, that's not Parfrey. That's Whitmore. Daly Whitmore, Parfrey standing. That's Maximus. Oh, I'm mistaken.
The one sitting is Parfrey.
Parfrey. The guy standing is Daly. Gotcha.
Riveting radio, you two.
What?
Well, trying to identify actors under the appliances can be a bit tough.
The appliance is very important. This is the ape series.
It is a geek level. I'll give you that.
I just call them orangutans.
I think if you're not interested in that kind of thing, I mean, this is what this is.
But these are
I'm interested
actors who took a great risk at being under these heavy appliances, and they did great work under it.
And they're very good.
They're established.
They're established actors.
Major actors. And can you imagine? I mean, it was not built to be comfortable. They must be dying under those things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ah.
Dun, dun, dun.
He speaks. That's Whitmore.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even talking to him.
And this is a very involved sequence, this courtroom scene. It really takes up a lot of screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And then this establishes their world. He's stating it.
And from a logic standpoint, the light in this room doesn't make sense. It's your 20th Century Fox high-key lighting. But
it works.
It looks nice.
Composition.
And actually, Leon Shamroy did this a lot in Cleopatra. He shot Cleopatra, and his light didn't make sense, but it looked nice.
I like the use of the foreground objects, essentially the foreground parts of the set.
All of this stuff they're saying right now, to be saying that in 68, I wasn't alive then, so, but it must have been brave. Either that, or have we digressed in the last 45 years over how we look at things religiously and politically.
No, I think
everything they're saying right now is, if you said this today, even if presented with some sort of evidence, it would be compared to the same thing as what they're witnessing. Would they be able to accept it? Would we be able to accept it?
I think it's not so much accepting. I think it's there's such a larger financial group of people that would either boycott or not see the film that the makers would want to.
Well, I don't say it's so much the financial thing. I think it's just essentially.
No, it's like Juno came out, and Juno came out, and actually, both sides got on side of it. The religious right got on the side of it of, see, it's anti-pro-abortion.
No, but this is the point. Okay, but you're getting it. It's not about both sides. It's not a matter of sides. It's a matter of people have taken essentially points of views and made it so that you can't actually talk about them, because then you're actually become hypersensitive, because now you're actually challenging my system of beliefs, and therefore I must make it so that your system of beliefs is not valid.
Yes.
Which actually this goes back and reflects. It takes it to its extreme, essentially, once again, using science fiction to say, this is our world. I even asked them, like, what is this article or whatever? Like, how would I know? I don't know your culture. Well, then that means, you
that
know,
means
you're legitimate.
Idiot, yeah.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Right, right.
I want you to know, I had a breakthrough just now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume there's a skylight that we can't see. This light now makes sense to me.
Tim's just making it all logical. I actually thought there was a skylight because of all these holes in the wall.
You know, I think so, in my eight
right there, that would be a skylight to have that light.
Architecture blueprint, blueprints. There was a skylight in
the courtroom.
In the courtroom, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, in my Planet of the Apes concordance,
I can relax now. I can watch the film.
You know, in a way, this is the center of the film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It presents everything in this one scene.
And basically determines his fate. Mm-hmm. And states how they're going to deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this would you agree with that, John, as far as script, storyline?
Two things, it really does. Right. It presents, like, three things. One, his fate. Two, it really hammers the point that Cornelius has done these findings out in the Netherlands, the Forbidden Zone. This is where it really shows that the bad guy is worse than we thought. I mean, usually that shows up the 60-minute mark, and the 60-minute mark was Dodge.
Right.
This is like 10 minutes later. It'll show you what Zaius is willing to do to someone to keep, you know,
his faith intact. Worse than the worst than the bad guy.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I understand what you're saying by bad guy, and I'll let us get through this one.
Well, bad guy, opponent of the
because
hero.
Because I understand what Zaius, I don't want to defend him, but from his point of view, he has to do this to preserve his society because he knows the challenge and the threat that this poses if this creature were to flow freely through ape society because it would rock everything they believed in. It's like someone coming back and saying...
But that's like saying then it was okay to throw Copernicus in jail because he said the Earth went around the sun.
I'm not saying that, but...
But you understand why people said that back then and why he was
I understand
in jail.
Why they did that. I don't defend it in any kind of way.
Gotcha.
Well,
but you understand it.
You know, or jailing Galileo for his life. That was completely wrong.
whenever
but,
I
once
see
again, but you're dealing with religion because the whole thing of faith versus science, which is of course you know what
Lost
is all about.
I always like that scene is because I always wonder. I always picture the movie in my head of what must the Landon have been going through during this whole time. He must have somehow presented knowledge to them, and they lobotomized him to prevent it.
Yep.
Either because they knew Charlton Heston could, or after. When was that, and how did that storyline go for him?
Actually, really well, you know, I should think with Landon, I think he got knocked out in the raid, and I think they probably found him, and they saw that he was different and said...
Well, he probably started talking.
Well, no, that's what I mean. He showed some sort of intelligence, and they were like, screw that.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's Jack Nicholson this sumbitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they had to. And that's why he turns to him, and that's why Heston turns to him and says, you did this to him.
Yeah.
Well, and you did this on purpose. And that's why they were, this is the only reason this courtroom allowed them to go outside and say, oh, yeah, where is that guy you said that is so intelligent, just like you? Oh, that guy.
Yeah.
Hmm. Right. They want to basically say that he's an aberration, that he's making it all up, that he didn't fall from the sky.
Sure.
He's not an alien from outer space.
Exactly.
So you could actually redo Planet of the Apes and just kind of take the same thing and just kind of strip out the ape stuff, make it humans with an alien.
Sure.
And do all these kind of things.
You know, just watching this again right now, I am just so struck yet again at what serious science fiction this movie is. For the time it came out, what a quantum leap, social commentary, political, what they're using it for you know, a spaceship rocket sci-fi movie, what was known in those times. It's really great.
Now watch this real quick. We got Speak No Evil, Hear No Evil.
Yes.
Yeah, that's one.
Which was not part of the original script. I think that was occurred on set.
Yeah.
And I remember a quote Schaffner said, that's the one thing he regretted of the film. He thought he took it a little too far.
Well, it did become cheap.
Well,
I could be wrong. I could be paraphrasing, but I think I remember reading that.
You kind of accept it for... I mean, they've already thrown in little phrases and different things. But
and it's good comic relief, too.
Yeah. And now they're getting on basically all the advance of any knowledge. Now they're getting on Cornelius. And it's all about maintaining order in the society.
And do you see that? He even said, let them talk and let them paint themselves in a corner.
Right.
Now they don't even want to hear it, which is what really is true,
right?
You know, that is the true statement.
That is true statement. Way
so
back.
he's under the belief that hey, I came from another planet, and they're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. What it is isn't true anyway.
And they're struggling with science when actually she's actually stumbled on the truth, though. Of course, it happened over millions and millions of years.
But I love how they cover their ears and everything. It's like, just come on.
Also, I think Inherit the Wind, the movie was in the early 60s. It's scientific heresy. So they want to squelch all knowledge that differs from what they want to have.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but I'm a little bit of a pessimist, and I could see this conversation happening if other life forms landed on this planet.
Holy.
Yeah, please.
That's what I'm serious. You could actually try and remake this.
Our political and religious leaders would go absolutely insane and just ignore it all and just be like, whatever. Come on.
Yeah, right. Because then the question is, do they have a soul?
Yeah.
And then,
Well, what
does
it mean?
There's a book called The God Hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Really? What's it
about? Never read it, but.
Aliens.
God Hypothesis about aliens? And how we deal with them?
I think so. Is it? I don't know. I've read it so long ago. I've read so many
I've never
books
read
about
it. I just heard of it.
Well, you mentioned it. That's why I thought I'd ask
you. Yeah, it has to do with the whole question of...
I like actually this whole beat of silence right now. Everything's just been kind of going to that. Yes? I like how it's also the swivel's not where the hinge is on the door.
Yeah.
So now, Serge, James Daly was one of the orangutans on the council. He was the one furthest screen right? And he's the father
of
Tyne Daly and Tim Daly.
Tim Daly, yes.
And I love how they have this scene of, I know you're telling the truth, and yeah, I know yeah. everything you're saying, and yeah. And he's, but in private, it's time for me to get real with you. I'm yeah. not an idiot. I know. Yeah. And but I'm, you know what? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I'm using you. Yeah. I'm using you to get rid of the people that are causing me trouble.
Not well, just that, but also what Serge has, the keep order. And,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, he is the keeper of the knowledge. Yeah. He can't let this...
Right. Well, you could say that about our medical profession, too, and keeping out homeopathic stuff and herbs and acupuncture.
Just say it, marijuana. Come on, John. Come on.
Oh, marijuana. Well, medical
I
marijuana.
Think that's to a lesser extent, but that's to the great, you know, to the greater extent. Well, I don't know. I mean, he does actually pose... He challenges their beliefs. It's as if we had literally an ape out of the jungle right now and say, I can speak, and we would not be able to deal with it. It's like, what do you mean? Well, I came in a spaceship. I came from X year. Literally turn it around.
Well,
look at that. I'm sorry. Look at that rig on him. That is not comfortable. He's got his arms way back behind him. Look at that on Taylor.
Yeah, because I went out with the girl once, and we used to... Oh, never mind.
I love Maurice Evans. He has a cigarette holder.
After about 7 hours, I didn't enjoy it at all.
Just seven, huh? Maurice Evans has a cigarette holder, and that's what he used all through shooting because of his monkey appliance.
He couldn't get it in.
In order to smoke. And so he just incorporated it into the scene. And they had to actually feed themselves looking into a mirror. At lunch, they wouldn't damage the appliances.
Oh, wow.
And watch the mirror and put the fork into their own mouth through the appliance.
Oh, here's
so you hear him?
And he's admitting
he just
that.
Yeah. He just echoed the line that they said, where there's one another and another. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, he also just explained it. Yep. Hey, no,
I'm just saying,
in terms
of writing, he just echoed the same line as they had before.
Yeah.
Dr. Zayas originally was the part slated for Edward G. Robinson, but he was too ill. Mm. And he did the makeup test, Charlton Heston, to sell the studio on the film, but he said he would not be able to endure the makeup for the entire feature film, so he dropped out. And went to Maurice
Evans. Were we lucky or unfortunate that we never got to go and see? He's a man, I tell you.
Yeah, I'll see.
See, the interesting thing is that Zayas still insists that he's lying. He still can't process what Taylor is saying, the whole truth of it.
Yeah.
No, I think...
Which I find very interesting, they're able to stick to their circumstances
right.
and not say, oh, this is everything you say, therefore I will believe everything you say. He cannot conceive.
Well, and it
says.
Makes sense, because that's what human beings do. I mean, it's like Tim looking for the skylight. You know, that's what the human mind does. The human mind goes, okay, I got these, and I got this. But how do I possibly make them fit together?
Yeah.
And then...
It's a great
scene.
See,
but I feel the exact opposite in the sense of... He knows... He understands every single thing about Heston. He understands it all, but he refuses to allow his mind to accept it. That's the difference.
I don't know. Well, what except that he came from a...
That everything Heston is saying is true. He intellectually gets it. And we find out later he does because he knew where all the baby dolls are later in the film when they do the architecture digs. He knows all this stuff. He knows it all, and he knows it's all real, but he refuses to admit it even to himself.
You know what? I disagree with that. I actually think at that point when he's talking to Heston, his mind cannot expand big enough, and his mind can only expand big enough of... Oh, there's another tribe of you in the Forbidden Zone.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that. And then when he finds the baby doll, his mind gets stretched even further, but then he's like shut
down.
But
he's the one that created the... When we see later, when we see all that stuff, he's the one that created the Forbidden Zone. That's why it is forbidden. Not him, but the intellectual society that they have, the orangutans, they created that because that's why it became the Forbidden Zone. Don't you go in there because those archaeological digs
were founded. No. Actually, no. I disagree with that. The whole thing... Oh, hang on. We got to watch Lucius actually knock out Julius. I love Lucius, man. Lucius is one of my favorite characters. bam.
Lucius
is the young kid who's like into the demonstrations and everything.
I wish you would have hit him a few times more though.
That's okay. Julius is not that bad. The Forbidden Zone was actually it was irradiated. So basically, mm-hmm. it was created way before they were all born, and basically you couldn't go in there because it was of the radiation from, as he put it, the humans had created. So it wasn't a matter of keeping the civilization away. He has no idea. He only imagines what he can find there. That's why he's saying he can only process. He can't process that he came from the sky. Well, he has to say, "I hear what you're saying. He's probably right, but I can't." No, he's got to come from a tribe because I cannot understand.
I believe he believes that.
That he comes from a tribe.
That he comes from a tribe and everything else. But I digress until that scene comes up, and then we'll talk about it then.
Okay. Real quick. So this is when they escaped him, or helped him escape, because you don't really escape someone.
They help him escape.
Is 81 minutes, and it's actually at the 75-minute mark, usually in a script, where things are so bad for the hero that somebody has to help him. And so this is the helping scene, because otherwise Taylor would be screwed.
I like that. Do you have any clothes for me?
Yeah.
Oh!
Ooh, that's a
Zero's line.
He's like a topsy turvy.
That stinks.
Like,
well, so do you. Like all men. Oh my god!
The hits just keep on coming. Yeah. He's like, can't I just get a moment? Like, I want to get back to being me, and he just can't.
And it's a great line.
It's relentless.
Her. Right.
It's day for night.
All men look alike to apes.
Yep.
Just right.
Well, I tell you exactly. Yeah.
Let's not even go there.
In this little lull, I want to talk about Lucius. I like Lucius because he's instrumental in the third act. Essentially, he helps them escape, and then he's there. And then, of course, in Beneath, you know, we don't see him or anything. So when it came along to escape from the Planet of the Apes, and they escape and they travel back, I'm like, but what happened to Lucius? They left Lucius behind. Lucius is dead. What the hell?
He's a hippie in this town. He's a smoking dope and
why'd they take Dr. Milo? They should have taken their nephew. But anyway, I digress. This is just how I felt when I saw
speaking
the
of Lucius, the actor who plays that part, I recognize his voice. And I remember he was on an episode of Lost in Space called The Haunted Lighthouse. And he played a character called J5, who helps Angela Cartwright out
really?
For the whole.
Holy
so
God.
If you ever want to see his work, he's in Lost in Space.
His name's Lou Wagner.
There you go.
And actually, I think he appears on some of the DVD special feature stuff, or whatever documentaries they did.
Well, now that we know how the production was of those cornfields and right here, we know that they filmed these sequences back-to-back. The beginning chase.
All the ranch
stuff.
Right here,
Roddy McDowall is awesome.
Yeah, he's great.
What a great actor.
He's like...
I like now how it's like... NRA, sons of bitches.
That's right.
Well, no, he's just like saying...
That's actually
why
he joined the NRA, because of this movie. He said, I'm...
No.
He said, I'm never walking alone without a gun because there might be an ape around the next one. <morning. laughs> I read that interview.
In the Ape Gazette.
Ape Gazette.
The point is that here's Cornelius, and he's trying to assert his authority as an ape, and Taylor was like, forget it. Ain't going to happen. You know?
Watch out, Charles.
Nova getting them in trouble again.
That's an interesting moment because that really didn't need to be in the script. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, it didn't really.
They wanted to throw Linda Harrison a bone, I guess. Yeah. And say,
but I mean, it's nice.
But it, yeah, exactly.
It showed them really connect.
Well, in the same respect, she wants to go back to she is a primitive animal, essentially, and she wants to go back to what she thinks she knows because she does what she thinks. She doesn't think.
And it gives Charlton Heston a moment to be soft and really connect rather than.
What is it the humans have? Was it called the limbic brain that animals don't? It's like we have humans have three parts to their brain, and I think animals only have two.
It's the squirrel part and the metallopoteca.
Thank you, John. I'll remember to ask you.
But
next
Serge,
time.
My wife agrees with you.
About what?
I only have two parts of my brain.
And again, we're seeing an incredible, desolate location shot.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, what a hard film to make. All the work. Look at this.
Oh, I love
back
this
to Lake
shot.
Powell.
This is the best shot ever.
I think that's a match shot, actually.
No, I don't think so. I think it's
that's
on location.
Where that was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a dang good one if it is.
Well, if you look at the edge of it.
I'll have to check my Blu-ray.
No, watch this. This is fantastic.
Now, the shot coming up is a match
shot.
That's a match shot, definitely.
You
can kind of tell. It is.
Mm-hmm.
How? Where?
Serge, I've learned in this shorter period of time that I will agree with you. Now, he is...
Imposed. It looks like superimposed.
No, but that
I think it's a glass plate, whatever. But that center part, that whole center part is
this back part.
This is
it's
all
not
real.
That it's a painting. Yes. It's an actual location, but it's merged together with other parts of film.
And we invite you.
Got it.
As you're watching the film, point at the screen too.
Yeah, literally the glass is in the middle part. Mm-hmm. So they're shot actually looking at each other. And he's just given the explanation about why the whole place is bad.
I thought that was a real shot at first. You guys are good.
It's supposed to be. And it's done its job if you believe it.
Yeah.
Right. And they're good, the filmmakers, yeah.
Wait a second. Are you telling me that there's no such thing as talking apes? Don't do this to me. Don't shatter my...
John?
Don't shatter the fourth wall or whatever they call that thing.
That sound that Jerry Goldsmith... Boom!
Yeah.
The back is like a cousin to the wind chime, the famous Universal Studios wind chime that was in Omega Man. Boom!
Oh,
where you
really?
Have the tub of water, and you have a chime off suspended off a rope, and you hit the chime and drop the chime into the water at the same time.
Oh, really?
But what Goldsmith's using here is a cousin to that sound. I don't know what he's using, but it's a wonderful sound.
Now, all the shots we're seeing of them, you know, going here, going down essentially to the shore, echoes all of the traveling shots we had at the top of the film.
Right.
So it's essentially it's mirroring the structure backwards of it. So now we know that we're going essentially towards the end.
Well, exactly. We're basically at 90 minutes. When Nova said she wanted to stay, that was 1 hour, 27 minutes, which is the end of the second act. And this is definitely the end of the second act, beginning of the third act.
And Charlton Heston gets to shave.
Wouldn't the escape have been the beginning of the third act?
No, the escape is...
darkest. Because isn't end of the second act darkest moment?
End of the second act, I would say the end of the second act is when... Zayas shows up with the gorillas, and then there's a choice of either fighting, shooting, killing, but they try something different, which is prove to me, and what we'll talk about, prove to me, which is the 91, which is the twist into the third act. He says, prove to me, and then I will let them be free.
That's the third act. Okay, so we're still in the second act.
Yeah, we're still in the second act. Yeah.
Okay.
And locations that were used, is it Point Dune or Point Doom? In California. This is where it's shot at. I think it's Point Doom, it's called.
Point Dune?
If it's...
There's a Point Dune. I don't know.
Then it must be Point Dune.
Okay.
All the surfers are cursing you now.
Or Mount Dune?
That's...
Actually, I just had friends who went there this weekend with their dogs and ran around. They said it's great. Very beautiful.
Right around here, then.
It could be. Maybe if we look, we can see them.
I think they went up to the cave. Lucia's like, pick up a gun.
That's great. Shut up.
I'm in charge. Well, because he's a leader. He's naturally a leader, so he's going to take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
The one's up there, too.
See? See,
he's denying. Apostate.
Now listen, he's been there before. Yeah. Going back to my argument, he's been here before. Yeah.
Oh,
he knew exactly where to go.
Yeah.
I don't remember that line.
Didn't that man be monogamous?
But what's also great was with that line helped reveal too that he still doesn't think this is Earth. He's really
Heston doesn't.
Well, Heston has no idea.
That's what I'm saying, Heston, right?
But there's
a lot of conjecture as to how much Rod Serling had to do by the time the finished script came out. But you got that twist ending, the whole ending.
His, right?
It's absolutely got to be Serling.
Oh yeah, that's very Twilighty.
I mean,
See, now I love how Heston's breaking down the hierarchy here, saying, see, not only does he control this, but he also controls this. So you guys go ahead and believe him all you want. But
And Rod Serling did a tremendous amount of social commentary in Twilight Zone episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And breaking down political statements and all his stuff about, oh, my gosh, through the 50s, the live television, the censorship, all the political issues he went up against. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of his hand in Apes, you know, in this script.
Yeah. Right, and so then this is the twist.
And now he wants to use the scientific evidence to basically get him to back off on what the scrolls say was the reality.
Right, which is
and of course he makes Lucius stay behind. Hang on, he's just a teenager. He's like, damn, come on, man.
He walks like a teenager.
Which is definitely what it was like during the 60s. That's what the whole counterculture was about.
What a great set, though, to build that stuff up against the side of the mountain like that.
You know, I mean, and that's important. I mean, it was in the 60s. You know, that was the whole thing in the 60s was shifting of a sense of power from always being part of the establishment and the authority to the younger generation. The younger generation actually had a voice, which it never really did before.
Right.
And this is all touches on that shifting also of that.
And as we go in,
we're now 40, 50 years past that.
Well, it's also that the whole older generation, established generation, is just bullshit. They're just trying to hold on to their power, and they're not willing or ready to look at, you know, what's really true. But that's been going on for every generation.
See, but that always happens. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And now the interesting thing. Yeah, go ahead, Curtis.
No, I believe that, Doctor. Is it? What's the orangutan?
Yeah.
Zayas? I feel that one time he had the ideology of a young man and everything, and now he's just pushing it all the way, no different than we do in today's political climates, where people at one time were leftish Democrats or whatever from the 60s, and at this modern era, they're like, well, this, you know, we're older now, and, you know, we'll push all that aside, so they refuse to see all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I often thought that his generation, Zaelius' generation, is the one that actually made these archaeological digs, because it doesn't look like these forts and these ladders and everything else were built
yesterday. No, Cornelius, actually, in the movie, Cornelius did this whole archaeological dig. It doesn't mean that Zaelius didn't. I mean, I hear what you're saying there, but it's that Zaelius essentially. But that's what we get back. He's now the keeper of the knowledge. As he's moved up, he is now the man in charge. He's not a lowly orangutan. He has to protect the society against the knowledge that's, I guess, that's separate, that doesn't follow the doctrine, I guess. I mean, I guess if you look at it, I don't want to make a whole thing about it. But in terms of which books are part of the Bible, of the New Testament, and which are considered, I guess, lesser books, I don't quite know how to talk about that.
Like, look at this. I mean, these are conversations you still have today whenever, you know, a new Yahoo story shows that there was a dig or something that, you know, in whatever part of the world, and they find all these things, and then the religious right saying, no, that's just whatever. You mean it's a million years old? No, it can't be.
But you don't find a doll, you know, in digs from
They also found
batteries, supposedly, and that made no sense whatsoever. How can you have a battery hundreds of thousands of years ago? And
that type of
stuff, that's what I'm saying. That stuff gets pushed aside because it doesn't fit at all.
Well, then
it doesn't fit into the puzzle.
Yeah. But that's also what I learned at UFO conferences, so that could all be bullshit.
Watch out, John.
That could be too, John. But, that's right.
But it's my world, and I live in it, and I enjoy it.
And also, I've come to understand that this cave also has a skylight.
That's right. That's in the blueprints also.
Yeah.
That or a giant mirror that reflects the light out of that one little hole.
And now, it's interesting because Taylor has kind of taken a backseat, and now here he's putting it all together, but he hasn't put together where he is.
Yeah, I know.
Because once again, it's his cognitive dissonance because I've gone to a planet that's on the other end of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. It happens to be similar.
Yeah. Now, I want to know, how does he know that what a heart valve looks like?
He's Batman. He's just following
the clues. Oh, come on. He can know some things. Now, this is interesting. Nova keeps on playing with the doll.
What's she going to do with that doll? What's going to happen?
I don't know. Nice shot. Mm-hmm. Look at that. That's the use of the frame. Mm. Very nice.
That's the Lord.
I like how cool Zaius is. Like, you can say whatever you want. this place is still going to be blown up.
That's it.
I'm still going to arrest you all.
The doll spoke.
Uh-huh. And now you have the evidence. After several thousand years.
Yeah, that's good workmanship.
It's good batteries. That Nova, she had to get in the way. Should have shot Zaius right there. Mm-hmm.
So if Nova has a meltdown, do you call her Supernova?
Oh, nice. Oh, we almost got through this without you.
Did you know they actually named a car Nova when they went to Mexico and it didn't sell? That's because Nova means no go.
No go? So they had to rename Nova's it. Constipated. Yeah. No wonder she's...
No. No.
Tim, you dirt.
Tim. Cultural differences.
Nope. Watch this one.
Oh, that's right. It's a good shot. See? Oh, that's right. Oh.
Gorilla down.
They don't have radios.
Didn't want to do that.
Okay. I'm acting.
That's right.
Great fake out, man.
Uh-huh, now I can get back.
Ah, now he drops. Now the mama, is that like at the end of Escape?
It's almost the same voice.
It is almost.
Come on.
I also like how he doesn't say pull back. He says withdraw.
We'll see his fire withdraw. Hey, he's British. What do you want?
No, I like that. It makes him a little more...
He came from England.
Because he did that before, which made him seem a little more highly educated. You know?
It's interesting that, once again, we have all the... It's only the gorillas that are the muscle. You don't have any orangutans or in the muscle. Poor Lucius.
Mm-hmm. 60 statements.
You can't trust the older generation. Absolutely, yeah. Go Lucius. Mm-hmm.
No longer Nova.
That's right. Just for this female.
Well, does he know her name is Nova?
He named her.
Oh, where was I? Sorry, guys.
Well, I guess he probably figures... If I say Nova, you're not going to know who.
Right. They'll be like, who?
You know, the human here. It's like
you have to refresh my memory. Where did he name her?
He named her whenever he was in the cell after he got.
Oh, and we must have. I must have been talking.
He was just like, hey,
sorry.
I'm going to call you Nova.
That's very good. Actually, one of my favorite parts of the film is coming up is when, and it's going to be in a few minutes, when he actually reads from the scrolls.
Yes, I do too. And actually, that's like the next... That's actually when he strikes back, because he reminds Heston what he really thinks of the human race.
Right.
And if you see Heston's face, you'll see that he actually agrees. Or see, right now he's all cocky. Man is better than apes.
Right. Well, man was there first.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he throws it back at him.
This is very important. Yeah. Maurice Evans' dialogue right here.
See, Heston's mind goes with, it wasn't man effing himself up.
Right. Yeah, no, he did. He did know in specifics, but Guardian the Terrible. That was Lawgiver. I'm sorry.
He carries the Bible with him.
I think that's great.
Well, it's the Lawgiver. Wow.
That is. Yeah, that's powerful. I mean,
that's heavier.
He is the harbinger of death.
That's heavier than any of our scripture.
Yeah, that's right.
Keep these people at bay.
Basically indicting these other creatures, and this other species, because they will destroy themselves, and they will use up everything, and then they will use everything you have.
Yet it's ironic that they're following, obviously, in the same footsteps.
Yeah. Well, and Heston knows that it's true.
Right.
Which is what's so...
It's great characters. I mean, all these characters
in this.
But that's
why, like, Lucius, I mean, he comes in the third act, and I mean, he's another whole other person. He just doesn't.
It's really great work in the writing.
Yeah. Well, it's also what's really nice too is Heston's response, the character's response is out of he just told him that all men are terrible, harbingers of death. But his response is actually, I'd like to kiss you goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually shows...
Because he's saying, I am different.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
right.
Even though I can agree... Yeah. No, I agree man is like that, but that's why I left.
Yep.
I agree, essentially. Right. Yeah, man will mess everything up. I'm out of here. I want to make a better place. But I'm still separated from my emotions.
I just love how it comes all down to the characters here. In the writing, it's not spectacle. It's not, you know, let's see what we can do. Production-wise, dazzle you here and there. It's all about the people, quote-unquote, the characters that inhabit this world. And I feel like I've gotten to know each one of them.
Yeah. And getting back to the Lucius thing, but what I like is that really emphasizes the whole generational thing amongst them all.
Yep.
Now, there's a story that...
I love his reaction. Yeah.
There is a story that Charlton Heston ran into Kim Hunter after the filming of Planet of the Apes. It was at some screening, some function, the red carpet. She came up to him. Chuck, how are you? He looked at her like a movie star would look at an autograph hound, was uncomfortable, backed off, and walked away. He did not recognize her.
That's so
because
funny.
Only time he saw her, she was in the appliances.
Yeah.
And she said, Chuck, it's me, Kim.
That's funny.
And then he recognized her. It is great how the writing uses Dr. Zaius.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, this is what I was saying, is that I mean, I know Dr. Zaius is the antagonist, but from in his world, he is the defender of everything, and Taylor is the intruder.
Yeah.
Taylor himself has not done anything bad.
Look at this. Words of wisdom right here.
You may not like what you find.
Don't look for it, Taylor.
Don't go that way.
It's like that's prophetic.
Say. It's like I always say, never look in a woman's purse. You may not like what you find.
Mm-hmm.
You think I'm kidding.
Oh.
Purse. I'm kidding.
I just replaced the word purse with past, so.
Or anything else.
Exactly. It's like, what? Yeah.
In other words, don't go looking too hard for what you're looking for. You're really not going to like it. And see, it's like, let him go. I mean, the Zaius' character is so, he's a really great character.
The seal of the cave.
Now, that's not nice.
I told you he's a bad man.
He's bad. Dr. Zaius? Or Dr. Zaius? Rock me, Dr. Zaius.
What I do is no pleasure.
Ah. Why must knowledge stand still? See?
Which is pretty prophetic.
But from his point of view, he has. But that's not really the truth. I mean,
in his culture, in that culture, he knows the great, you know, he knows the secrets, and they need to be kept secret because otherwise it would tear apart his society.
Right. Or give birth to a new society.
But Taylor becomes the threat to that society. The thing is that it's about, because it has to do with a species which he's learned since, from whatever, actually destroyed everything else that was in the scrolls.
Right.
So of course.
But still, if they once, it's like Copernicus and the Earth goes around the sun. At that time, that destroyed the society. That made the church weaker. That made everything else. We're not the center of the Earth, or we're not the center of the universe.
Well, because that was not just, because here it's not just knowledge.
But it gave birth to a new society or whatever.
Okay. But here it was not just knowledge. It was knowledge of the species that they were taught to fear. Fear. They were taught to fear man because man, as he said, was the harbinger of death.
Right.
He will destroy all others. And that's the danger that came out. And the thing is, we saw this all from Taylor's point of view. If we'd seen the movie from Zaius's point of view, it would have been completely different. But of course, we don't know apes, so it had to be from Taylor's point of view. Also, the story is about. I mean,
well, sure.
It depends on when the time comes.
Well, Zaius is trying to save his job.
Yeah, well,
he's trying to save his society.
By subduing their knowledge, he's allowing them to never become what man became.
Let me ask this.
Yeah, but they already did it because we saw them hunting man. I mean, we already saw they did become what man.
Important question here. Now, what is it he's seeing? Is he seeing the torch?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That would be the torch.
No, wait. He sees the torch, and I'm sorry to be so particular about this. I've always wondered about this. He then walks on like it's nothing.
No. He's looking at it.
Okay, so it's all kind of part of the whole thing. So he's
and now we see the top.
Well, he saw the whole thing at the same time.
Yeah, we're revealing what the audience sees.
Okay, all right. Okay.
And that's practical, actually. That's a real foreground object.
I thought it was glass painting.
Nope. They built something.
I thought, okay.
See that zoom? Look at that. No, that's practical.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And Heston fought tooth and nail to retain God damn them all to hell.
Yeah, good. God damn you all to hell.
The studio wouldn't let him say it, but he said, no, that's exactly what it implies, and that's what this line needs. And so he was able to say it.
And now he also realizes that Zaius was right.
Yeah.
Zaius was, exactly.
What a moment for an actor. Who gets to deliver something like that?
Great. That was
an optical. And this is the genius of Jerry Goldsmith, folks. He didn't score it. That guy knows when to be silent. The power of film.
Right. You don't need, right.
He knew when to remain silent. That's an incredibly important lesson to film score composers.
Right.
Now, would he be the one to say that, or would it be the director?
Yeah.
Both, but Jerry Goldsmith, from what I know of, he had an unerring sense of when to remain silent for the most dramatic impact. in films.
Yeah, it's great to see.
He just wasn't sick that day or something?
No, it wasn't just,
it's great to see this.
And we have just the sound of the ocean. Because it's disturbing, it's unsettling, and it leaves you to ponder, and you have nowhere to go to distract you from the impact of what they were just trying to say.
Right. Cool. And also, I just want to say about the Statue of Liberty, I think that was a glass painting.
Oh, it was. It was an optical, too. They blew it up. Okay. And the zoom, it was an actual optical zoom.
An optical zoom, okay.
Yeah, to come back out of that.
Right.
That's the way it looked to my eye, I will say that.
Well, sir.
Appjack, Arthur P. Jacobs Productions.
Yeah, Appjack, absolutely. So, well, I got to say, this, I haven't seen this in a few years. It holds up for me.
It totally holds up.
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal.
It absolutely holds up.
Wow.
Across the board in all the categories.
Because it's a film about ideas,
Yeah.
predominantly. And those will stand the test of time.
Ideas and characters. The characters were, and the acting was all done. And of course, Charlton Heston.
And I loved how she really liked him. It was kind of.
Zira is won over by him. Yes.
Yeah, that was just.
That was nice.
Well, she found him fascinating from the beginning. And also, she always had a heart. She never hated.
Yeah.
She never hated her subjects. But the interesting thing is, I mean, obviously, and this comes up in Escape, is that she did, you know, do vivisections on humans.
Yeah.
And she did see them as lower, but she could still have that compassion towards it. And that's why, I said that's really interesting if someone would take, I mean, you can't redo a film and just, you know, verbatim, but do the same, just flip it around and have an alien come down and deal in that same kind of satirical way. And I don't think you could do that. The only way you could have that kind of situation is in that way where you have a human go into an alien society that looks, that behaves just like, behaves just like humans. So guys, since you guys are, you know, well, I mean, you've seen this film, but you're not really well versed in the rest of the Ape universe.
I want to see the next one. I want to do the next one with you guys.
Okay.
Which one is the next one?
Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which came out in 1970.
So we should work that in. I vote for that.
I'll pick it up.
Yeah.
The way it worked, let me see, Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest, and then Battle.
Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Which I've actually, in my mind, come to appreciate more. Thank you.
Mama.
Jerry.
Mama. Actually, those aren't, that no, isn't no. me making any of those sounds.
No, I know. That's,
that's the actual two other grown-ups.
In the room.
Yeah.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes, I actually like, in a way, I mean, I don't think it's probably the weakest of the lot. Battle for the Planet of the Apes offers Roddy McDowall the most opportunity to develop his character and dominate essentially the film from beginning to end. Whereas in the other films, he's not actually, Roddy McDowall does not appear Beneath the Planet of the Apes. He comes back in Escape as Cornelius, along with Kim Hunter, and they share obviously the story. And then in Conquest, he plays Caesar, but it's a different kind of part. And then Battle, he has the whole film to himself, which I've just come to kind of appreciate more and more as I've gotten older. Other parts may not hold up as well, but it actually is, there's a lot of charm to it.
And Roddy McDowall did the series.
He did do the series too. He played Galen.
Galen.
That's right. And I don't know if he did the animated. There was an animated series for a little while where actually it took place in the future you were talking about. They basically changed. They had two astronauts or three astronauts come down, and it was a futuristic ape society.
Mm-hmm.
Let's actually briefly, and then we'll bail out of this. Have we all here seen the 2001 Tim Burton version?
Yes.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, I
and,
have.
And so, in just briefly, how do you think, what do you think of the phenomenon of remaking this classic? Because this is a classic film. It really just holds up together so well.
It's one of those things, it's like, I mean, as I sit here, I look at your poster of Lawrence of Arabia. It's like, how do you remake something like that? And it was a daunting task, and I just don't think Tim Burton was up to the... I mean, when we sit here and watch this film, and you say, when we talk about how well it holds up, how well the subject matter continues to this day, and it is grounded in our world as of right now. And I can tell you that my kids still enjoy the movie. Mm-hmm. Why do you need to remake it? Mm-hmm. And are you going to do any better? No. So when you try to change it, it's just not going to make any sense.
When I saw the 2001 version, I walked away with one thing, and that was how impressed I was. I was so impressed at how far makeup has come.
Mm. Oh,
beyond that, it didn't strike any chords or push any buttons for me.
Oh, yeah. For me, I was stunned. I thought the art, as usual with Tim Burton films, I thought the art direction and the costumes and the makeup were incredible. And I liked the physicalization that they had in Planet of the Apes. The way they had the apes now be able to actually be super apes and be able mm-hmm. to jump and actually physicalize it. Here, there's none of that kind of work.
Even play them.
Unfortunately, and I thought Tim Roth's performance was actually really superior.
Very good.
Yes, I agree.
But it was like the rest of the film could not come up to meet what all that was.
And well,
I mean, the scene when all the gorillas are running across the field like that was amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Once again, they're all great visuals. I mean, I think Tim Burton's a great visualist, but it didn't hold up together narratively. I know they had problems with the script, and also they had an actor bail out on them, I think, about 1 or 2 weeks before they were supposed to start.
A lead?
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg wasn't originally slated. I don't even remember who. Someone else was going to do it. They bailed, and so they brought him in. Mark Wahlberg did his job, and that was fine. I found the spaceship stuff interesting, and I liked the tie-in with Tim Roth's character and how it somehow suggested, of course, at the end, I'm going to spoil the end of the 2001 version when, of course, he comes down and sees, you know, the Lincoln Memorial.
Sure,
and, of
sure,
course,
sure.
It's got the whatever his, Tim Burton's, Tim Roth's name, Tim Roth's character up there. And I thought that was, wow, that's cool. Good twist. Now, if we just saw that movie, that'd be great.
Yeah.
So in a world of opportunities, they tried. I'm sure commercially they wanted to do it. I know they got Zanuck to come on board, and Zanuck got Charlton Heston to come in and do actually that scene in ape makeup, mm-hmm. which actually I thought Charlton Heston did as fine as he could, considering he was, I think it was the last thing he did. The thing he'd done right before that, I think, was Hamlet, or of any note, and where he played the player king. So, I still love this one. Mm-hmm. It's part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is,
John,
a core fundamental film.
You have anything to say, or have we basically beat that
one? I dig Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, he's great.
I think he's super cool. Love Brothers. I just remember coming away from that and just being just so much more action, but so much less substance. In my lot of the action films, sometimes they're just like a big bowl of frosting, as opposed to a really solid meal or even a good dessert. It's just a big bowl of frosting, and it's just not satisfying. I mean, at the moment, it can be kind of entertaining, but it's. Nothing like what we just saw here.
Right. So finally, actually, in terms of script-wise and structure, how this hold together?
Yeah, fantastic. If anyone wants to check it out, they can. I've done Inglourious Basterds and Planet of the Apes. You can get the 12 three acts and I break it down to 12 structure scenes within the three acts, and so you can check them out on structurenotformula.com, and I'm sure there'll be a link from... there's a link between filmgrok.com and my site, too.
I'll work on that.
Rock and roll.
Or actually, it will have been worked on already.
That's right.
So, all right. Anyway, thank you very much, guys. This has been Serge Delpierre.
John H. Ruby.
Tim McMillan.
Curtis Nelson.
And this has been Film Grok. See you later.